We are now in week 15 of our study of Genesis. Next week, we'll take a break from Genesis and focus on Advent. And at some point, or probably in January, we will resume in Genesis with the story of Abraham. Now, last week, we looked at an odd story about a naked and drunken Noah and the curse for one of his grandsons named Canaan. But in the end, at the end of Genesis 19, we see in verse 28, after the flood, Noah lived 350 years. Noah lived a total of 950 years, and then he died. Now, I don't know about you, but the older I get, the faster that time seems to go by. But I still could not imagine living 950 years. If you want to know what that feels like, ask Rod, because I think that's what he feels like right now. I'm saying he feels like that. I have no other commentary. But following chapter 9 and chapter 10, we get what is known as the Table of Nations. It starts off in verse 1. This is the account of Shem, Ham, and Japheth, Noah's sons, and who themselves had sons after the flood. And for the next 30 or so verses, we see all the descendants of Noah's sons, and it concludes with this verse. These are the clans of Noah's sons, according to their lines of descent with their nations, from these nations spread out over the earth after the flood. So it appears in this chapter that mankind is doing as he is commanded by God, and that is to go, be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth. But somewhere in this process, things are not what they seem to be, and sandwiched right in between genealogical records, we get a different story. Chapter 11. Now the whole world had one language and a common speech. As people moved eastward, they found a plain in Shinar and settled there. And you can see in the map, up there, Ariat was the mountains where Noah's Ark landed. And so they kind of went south and eastward to this wonderful plain called Shinar. So, Ariat is now part of eastern part of modern-day Turkey. And in this part of the story, we're still at the point where the descendants of Noah have begun their migration out of the mountainous region and are moving to a more fertile and forgiving land. The original language that's translated here as "they found" has a deeper meaning. It is implied in this phrase that they didn't simply happen onto this land by accident. They were intentionally looking for a good place to settle. And this place in Shinar seemed to be an ideal place for them. The plain is in the eastern part of modern-day Iraq, and at this time it would have been part of the lower Euphrates River Valley, which means the availability of water would allow production of vast amounts of grain and a centralization of wealth. Many archaeologists believe that the first evidence of civilization can be found in this region. They said the earliest known writings and literature, systems of law, evidence of city-states, advances such as the potter's wheels and sailboats and plows and metalworking with bronze and all kinds of even advanced musical instruments and other forms of things like weaving and leatherwork and masonry, all of these archaeological things are found in this region, kind of the very first of its kind. Now, what we don't know in this story is this all of Noah's descendants that have come here or just some of the clans? We don't know for sure. But we do know that according to the Bible, it was a place for a productive society and that there had to be a significant number of people judging by the work that needed to be done. Verse 3 says, they said to each other, come, let's make bricks and bake them thoroughly. They used brick instead of stone and tar for mortar. Then they said, come, let us build ourselves a city with a tower that reaches to the heavens so that we make a name for ourselves. Otherwise, we'll be scattered over the face of the whole earth. Well, we know the number of people here had to be a significant amount of people. Because in order to do this plan, you would need a great workforce. You would need people who gathered the raw materials for the clay bricks and the mortar. You would need people who processed the raw materials, formed the raw materials, baked the raw materials, and a great number of people who actually do the building of the tower. And in addition to all of these people, you would need a great number of support people, the leaders, the planners, the supervisors, as well as all of the people who provided the food, the water, the tools, and other things, right? Right? The farmers would have to grow enough grain to feed them and a whole bunch of other people. There had to be a lot of people going on. It was truly an organized society of producing an abundant number of resources needed for the undertaking of this great building program. But I want you to see two important things. Let's look at where the focus is. How many times do we see words like us, we, and ourselves? I count at least 10 times. Make no mistake, this society was just like our society today, highly focused in their personal success and their own legacy, stating they wanted to make a name for themselves. Now, how many times have we talked about naming things in the Bible and the importance of that? God named things in creation, right? He named the light. He named the waters, the land, and he even named Adam and Eve. Then he gave Adam the special privilege of naming the animals. And if we look forward, we know that Jacob's name was changed to Israel, right? A whole bunch of things about names that are important, even Simon's name being changed to Peter or Saul's name being changed to Paul. There's meaning in naming things. Naming things is about ownership, power and control, right? You get to name your kids, you get to name your dog, right? You have that authority. And here these people wanted to make a name for themselves. This means they wanted autonomy. They wanted control. They wanted power. And they wanted what they were doing to control people long after they were gone. Setting up a legacy. We want to make a name for ourselves that lasts forever. They wanted to be the great founding fathers of the civilized world. Number two, let us look at what is missing in this story. God is not mentioned. There are no altars, no offerings, no worship. No one is walking or talking with God. No one is looking back and retelling the stories of Adam and Eve or Cain and Abel. No one is talking about the wicked world that was destroyed by God and about the righteous man named Noah through whom all of creation was saved. There's no mention of covenants or commands from God. The closest we get to the mention of God is the heavens. To these people, the heavens was the dwelling place of God or gods. And by building a tower that reaches the heavens, they are declaring that by reaching there, they will be able to dwell as their own gods. If I can reach the heavens, I am therefore godlike. The society was so advanced, they decided they didn't need God. Do you hear that? This society was so advanced, they decided they didn't need God. Does that look or sound familiar? Because our society is so advanced, I think most of it has decided we don't need God. And not only do they not need God or ask for God's help or seek God in this, they are openly and willingly defying God's will. God's command was for them to go and fill the earth. Right? Hey, people, the God who destroyed the whole world because of sin, after saving your family, he wants you to spread out and multiply. That was God's will, God's command. And here they are, refusing to follow God, refusing to be scattered, to stay together and build something for their greatness. But in this story, God is not idly standing by. Genesis 11:5. But the Lord came down to see the city, the tower the people were building. Now, we know God is everywhere. But this is like the scene in the garden when God came looking for Adam and Eve and saying, "Where are you?" He knows where they are, right? Like asking our kids with chocolate on our mouth, "Did you get in the cookie jar?" We know the answer, don't we? This is like the scene where he went to Cain and asked him, "Hey, where's your brother?" God knows Cain killed Abel. This here is straight up biblical humor. Man was building a great tower, a tower to reach the heavens. And here the writer says it was so minuscule, such a pathetic attempt that God had to come down to see it. Like that's picture, right? Looking from space. What? I'm sorry. Are you building something down there? Isn't that funny? God's got a sense of humor here. No matter what great thing man has done, God trumps it. "Hey, God, we built a tower." And God just said, "I made the mountains." "Hey, God, we climbed that mountain." "Well, I created the whole earth." "Hey, God, we learned to sail around the globe." He said, "See that moon? I made that." "Well, hey, God, we broke the space barrier. We have rockets. We landed on the moon. We have telescopes." And God says, "The universe is so big, you still can't see the end of it. Keep trying. Good luck." No matter how much we have advanced, there's a lot of illnesses and cancers and stuff we can't cure, right? No matter how advanced we are, we haven't stopped murders, have we? We're an advanced society that we can produce more food than ever, but we still have people starving. No matter how much we want to play God, we are not God. Genesis 11, moving on. Lord said, "If as one people speaking the same language they have begun to do this, then nothing they plan to do will be impossible for them." Now, when most people, including scholars, read this, your first instinct is to think positively, as in, wow, if humans can work together, there's no limit to the greatness they can achieve. But I want to give you a different perspective. I don't think that's what the writer is saying here. Because what just happened? The flood. Why did they have a flood? Let's go back to Genesis 6. It says, "The Lord saw how great the wickedness of the human race had become on the earth, and that every inclination of the thought of the human part was only evil all the time." So what is there no limit to? No limit to their wickedness, no limit to their godlessness, no limit to how far they will go into being their own gods. Right? A similar thing happened with Adam and Eve. We go back to the fall in the garden. Genesis 3:22, "And the Lord God said, 'The man has now become like one of us, knowing good and evil. He must not be allowed to reach out his hand and take also from the tree of life and eat and live forever.'" God says, now that man has fallen, now that he knows good and evil, we cannot let a sinful man live forever. We must put limits on their ability to live sinfully. Right? Now that you're a sinful creature, I can't let you live forever. I cannot allow your sin to keep going and going and going forever. Right? God's putting limits on sin. And when we go back to Genesis 6, then the Lord said, "My spirit will not contend with humans forever, for they are mortal. Their days will be 120 years. So whereas Noah, right, and the people before him were living 800-900 years, do you see how God worked to limit how much sin could prevail? So now when we go back to this verse, we should see this verse differently. If it is possible for man to create schemes and try to become godlike, if it is possible man to find ways to really disobey God, it is possible for these people to return to unlimited wickedness and evil inclinations. So we need to do something about it. right? It's not that they're so advanced that they're going to do too many good or great things, build big things. It's that now that they're together, conspiring against God, trying to become godlike, we're going to have to put a limit on what they can do, or they're going to go right back to what happened before I destroyed the earth by flood. We're not going to let that happen again. So he does something in Genesis 11:7. Come, let us go down and confuse their language so they will not understand each other. So the Lord scattered them from there over all the earth, and they stopped building the city. That's why it is called Babel, because the Lord confused the language of the whole world. From there, the Lord scattered them over the face of the whole earth. Have we forgotten just how powerful God is? God in this moment says, if you can't work together in obeying my will, I'll make it impossible for you to work together in disobeying my will. So God said, new languages. And suddenly people couldn't talk, they couldn't communicate, and it forced them to scatter. Ultimately, in the end, God always wins. Their language, they're changed, they're scattered throughout the earth. God wins. And we must change how we think, because we are a culture focused on ourselves. Culture focused on success, not a culture focused on God. It was even true in the time of Jesus. In Luke 12, we find Jesus teaching. And in this passage of Luke 12, one of the points he is making is this from verse 4. I tell you, my friends, do not be afraid of those who kill the body and after that can do no more. But I will show you whom you should fear. Fear him after your body has been killed, has authority to throw you into hell. Yes, I tell you, fear him. Jesus in this passage is teaching the people, forget this world. Forget even the person that can take your life. Because no matter what anyone in this world pushes you to do or tries to take from you or even threatens your life, that person's not the eternal judge. We only have to worry about serving God because it is God who will determine our eternity in heaven or hell. So we need to live for God. And that's the whole point of his teaching. He goes on in verse 8 to say, I tell you, whoever publicly acknowledges me before others, the Son of Man will also acknowledge before the angels of God. But whoever disowns me before others will be disowned before the angels of God. So again, Jesus says, if you live for me in this world, I will welcome you to the eternal presence of God. But if you disown me, if you fail to follow me, then you will be judged for eternity. And that's the crux of his teaching here at this moment. And then in the middle of this teaching, he's teaching them to stop focusing on the world, focus on God. A man has a gumption to ask him this question. Luke 12, someone in the crowd said to him, Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me. Jesus, since you hold the authority of a teacher, a rabbi, I want you to solve a personal problem. You see, in their culture, the oldest son got the majority of the inheritance. I think it was about 75% of the inheritance went to the oldest son. Not to the oldest daughter, to the oldest son. Then the remainder of the sons, not the daughters, would split up the remaining portion. So if there were 12 sons, 11 of them divided up 1/4 of the goods, right? And this man who was the younger son saw this tradition as unfair. He wanted Jesus to make his life better. He wanted Jesus to raise his social and economic status. This guy's asking Jesus to make things fair. And this is after Jesus says, stop worrying about the things of this world, right? So I just love Jesus' response. Jesus is the king of sarcasm. Jesus replied, "Man, who appointed me a judge or an arbitrator between you?" And then he says to them, "Watch out. Be on your guard against all kinds of greed. Life does not consist in an abundance of possessions." Basically, he's saying, "Man, have you been listening to me? What I'm teaching here? I'm not here to make this life fair for you. I am here to help you be right with God so that you may inherit eternal life with God, not help you receive an earthly inheritance." And then Jesus says, "Do you see what happens when you're not focused on God? Do you see that I'm teaching that life is more than possessions we claim in this life? Forget about how much you have or don't have in this world." That's what Jesus is teaching him here. And because he knows people don't get it, he goes on to tell them a parable. So Jesus teaches them a parable, verse 16. He says, "The ground of a certain rich man yielded and an abundant harvest. He thought to himself, 'What shall I do? I have no place to store my crops.' Then he said, 'This is what I'll do. I will tear down my barns and build bigger ones, and there I will store my surplus grain. And I'll say to myself, you have plenty of grain laid up for many years. Take life, eat, drink, and be merry.'" You notice how many I's are in there? I, mine, I. Verse 20, "But God said to him, 'You fool, this very night your life will be demanded from you. Then who will get what you have prepared for yourself? This is how it will be with whoever stores up things for themselves but is not rich toward God.'" The Tower of Babel was all about man, about man's accomplishments, about man's society, about man's technology, about man's wealth. And the same is true in the second story. Right? The parable was about a man who wasn't concerned about giving to the poor, was he? He wasn't grateful to God for the abundance harvest. He didn't give extra to the church. He didn't do anything. It was all about him. And this young man that approached Jesus was worried about his inheritance and position in life. And no one in these stories is walking or talking with God. And here at this end of this verse, Jesus says we need to be rich towards God. What does that mean? Does that mean we can't have possessions? Does that mean we can't have an inheritance? Does that mean we can't build careers or businesses? No, that's not what we're saying here. It means our first priority is always to God. It means we put serving God ahead of everything. It means we're to live in a right relationship with God. It means that worship's a priority, living out God's will is a priority, and doing God's commands is a priority. So the question is, are you using your time, your gifts, and your possessions to serve God, or are you serving yourself? That's a real introspective question, isn't it? Is the first thing you do when you receive a paycheck is to give back to God? Is the first thing you do with abundance think about how you can help others? Are you using your time, your gifts, and your possessions to serve God? Or are you serving yourself? Now, I think as a whole, we as a church are moving in the right direction. But I still think there's a lot of room for us to rise up and work to be a church that's all in, a church that dwells richly with God, to give our all, to give everything to God first. If you are a person that God has blessed, that's fine. It's not that you have possessions, it's what is your priority with your possessions. And how do you serve God using those possessions?